What does the word intentional mean for you?
You know what? I was thinking of that, Ryan, while we were talking. And I think every part of how we live and work, and actually our entire conversation, was what intention do I have behind everything I'm doing?
Welcome to the Intentional Growth Podcast, the show that teaches you how to grow the value of a company with an end in mind. Host Ryan Tansom interviews top business leaders, authors, entrepreneurs, and other professionals who share their experience and expertise about buying, growing, and selling companies.
So I know we all wake up and have this underlying thought in our head is, I wonder what would happen to the business if I was no longer around. And we just kind of shove it to the side. And then we're like, okay, we just got a lot to do today. So we're going to get through today's activities and tasks and make sure we're moving forward and progressing. However, today on the show, I have an amazing guest, Sandy Hansen-Wolf, where she is going to describe to us her journey from becoming an accidental entrepreneur and then to the point where she intentionally grew the company to exit. And she became an accidental entrepreneur because her husband, when she was 30, got diagnosed with leukemia and ended up succumbing to the disease. And she talks about what happened when she had the business that she took over after 15 months of marriage. And she had to be, you know, dive right in at about $1 million in revenue to then grow it. She ended up growing it up to $8 million in revenue by putting intentional focus on the right strategies, her people. And she talks about how she processed the original event, you know, the emotions that she had to go through, how she handled it operationally in the business. And then as she was scaling the business, how she was making her decisions, which I found very fascinating as part of the conversation that, as she's talking about the different milestones, what was going through her head as she was making these decisions. And I think it's a very unique twist on the people's perspectives because of the incident that she went through. She knew that, you know, life is finite. So what are we going to be doing to this business to intentionally grow it, to have it at least be sellable down the road? And so Sandy's going to share with us, you know, her mindset along the whole way and the journey that she took in the business and then how that led to an eventual exit and how she ended up planning for a life after. Wonderful episode. And I appreciate her honesty and her ability to describe to her the story that I hope none of us have to live through. Again, another update is look forward to episode 300. I'm going to be having Matt Buskirk and Pat Hobby, my two partners at Arcona, on the show. We're going to be talking about what does intentional growth mean? What have we learned after 6 years of doing the podcast? You know, what is to come with the podcast? Because we have a new content strategy we're rolling out after episode 300 that I'm super excited about. So make sure you look out for episode 300. And with that being said, without further ado, here is my episode with Sandy Hansen-Wolf.
Sponsored by Arcona's Intentional Growth Digital Course, Ryan Tansom and Pat Hobby show you how to shift your mindset away from solving for annual income to focusing on strategies that create long-term value, giving you the freedom and choices to take control of the future destiny of your business. Accelerate your knowledge with 36 videos and dozens of exercises that combine decades of experience buying, growing, and selling companies. Learn more by going to arcona.io or visiting the show notes.
Sandy, how are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me, Ryan. It's always just a humble privilege to be on a podcast.
Well, I appreciate that. And I'm also honored because you have quite the story and you've got, you know, quite the journey you've been on. And but I just have to tell the listeners, right before we hit record, we were talking about where you live and it's actually up where I went to college. And you know, just the area that you live in is amazing. And we have so many interesting connections because you had reached out and on LinkedIn. I'm like, oh my God, you were on Built to Sell and you were on Sue Hawks' mm-hmm. podcast. So you kind of been sharing your story, which I'm honored to be able to help spread the story because it's very fascinating. So for the listeners, why don't you just kind of give a quick overview, Sandy, of what you're doing now, but then kind of the milestones that got you here. And then we'll go back and unpack the very interesting parts of the journey.
Sure. Be happy to. Yeah. So sharing, this could be a long story, so I will make it very succinct. So right now, fast forward to now, I exited a company, an agribusiness company that I own solely for 18 years, back in December of 2020. That was my late husband's company initially, and I took it over upon his death back in 2003. So what am I doing now is I've always had more than one business for about 15 years. And to me, it was a series of saying yes. Geez, where do I start?
Well, that's good. Well, because yeah. I mean, you've got a couple, you've got kind of a spinoff from the egg business, as well as you're doing some leadership coaching and such and speaking, right?
Yeah.
And we can talk about how that spinoff started. And I think, you know, I wanted to give that context because, I mean, that was a tragic thing that happened back in, was it early 2000s? So why don't you kind of would just walk through what happened? Because you had married your husband and you got some unfortunate news pretty fast after that and ended up being an entrepreneur by accident, almost is what it sounded like.
Yes. And so my first husband, Randy, was diagnosed with leukemia a month and a half before our wedding in October of 2001. And during that time in the hospital, we were just so grateful for the friends and the family that continuously supported us. And the one thing that we wish we would have had was someone to share their story. You know, as young people going through this, he was 30, I was 33. He was 33, I was 30. And, you know, we really wish someone that could have related to this battle, you know, so early out of the gate in our lives. And we're not the only ones that have gone through this. So we made a pact in the hospital, sitting in the hospital as he was getting treatments, that we would share a story whenever asked. And that's, you know, obviously didn't turn out the way I had envisioned. I thought he'd be sharing with me. And in 2003, he lost his battle to complications of leukemia. And I was tasked with the responsibility of what to do with his company, which on paper was our company. And really, it was an agribusiness company in Watkins, Minnesota, central Minnesota. And my thought and his was just sell it if something happens to me. And because of his absence in the company, and thank God we had great employees and great customers who stuck with us during those times. I came to find out upon his death that it was, you know, we had just bought out his partner. So we had some new debt to the tune of about $500,000, which in today's terms would probably be a few million for sure. And I didn't really have a good outlet for paying that off. And so because of the debt load, our company was suffering. And so it's hard to sell a company that isn't financially sound. So thought was that I would take it over and for 6 months, fix it and then sell it.
I just can't even imagine like dealing with all those emotions and problems at the same time. You know what I mean? How big was your team at the business at the time when you were spending the time in the hospital with your husband?
So we had probably about five or six people at the time. We had a business model, which I think still works really good now, of, you know, teaming up with our vendors and outside people that would help us too. So it was a small but mighty team. And again, gratefully, they were very dedicated to doing what they could.
Well, I just think you're trying to take the emotional, you're trying to handle like and process what the heck is going on with your husband who's going through that battle. And then there's this operational entity that's, you know, got to be paying off the debt and everything. Like where, like Sandy, like did your husband pass and then you jumped right in, or did you start jumping in after, like, or while that was going on? When did that transition happen and what were you doing prior to jumping into the business?
Yes. So I was not involved with the business. The only thing I really knew about the business is what a young spouse would know. You know, we were married for about a year and a half when he passed away. So it's kind of like, what did you do at work today? Like those dinner conversations. Yeah. That's kind of what I knew about the business. And he had great employees. You know, I really wasn't involved at all, that kept the business going while he was in the hospital going through treatments and so on. And I still am grateful for, to this day, and will always be grateful for that. So I, you know, it's kind of the same time as the funeral was happening. People were looking at me like, what's she going to do? Mm-hmm. And I didn't know either. I was working in insurance at the time, and I had taken a leave of absence to be his caretaker, basically, because he had so many appointments and hospital visits and so on. And I'm like, gosh, I don't know. Should I go back to that? And then it kind of, one of our sales reps told me, he had come to visit the house just to, you know, see how I was doing. And he said, hey, I've been telling people that you're taking over, that you'll be the one. And I'm like, oh,
leave it to the sales rep, right? Got to close the deal. Got to tell everybody what's going on.
Sandy's going to, you know, be taking it over and figure it out or whatever. And I can remember thinking in my mind, like, you know what, I probably could do that, before I knew that it wasn't financially doing that well. Mm-hmm. And again, just, we had great customers. We had a lot of them. We just, you know, perfect storm type of thing. So, so it was right after the funeral that I started having meetings.
So what was the business doing? And like, as far as like the operations, of what can you just give us a quick overview of like what the actual business was doing and products and services? How did it work?
Yes. So we were like a hobby farm store in look. So we had a retail space, and people would come in and get their calf feed and goat feed and chicken feed, kind of like hobby farm stores are now. Mm-hmm. And we also had a farm side where we delivered a lot of, you know, larger volumes to bigger farms, you know, or to farms where we would deliver bulk out on a semi to the big farms, and worked on delivering the nutritional supplements they needed and so on for mixing and feeding animals to the perfect method we should.
So in the Sandy, was the business, I think I recall, cause I listened to the Warlow interview with you, you guys were doing about $1 million or something like that in revenue. I mean, where did you even, like, how do you even start like jumping into a business like that with like the person that knew all the information is no longer with you? Like, how did you handle that? Like, what was the kind of order to getting up to speed and then coming up with a plan?
Mm-hmm. You know, really day to day learning. Yeah. In the midst of a very broken, grieving heart, asking a ton of questions, you know, basically coming in, I don't know, I kind of felt at the time that I was in a desperate situation. Like, either I could probably see what I could get for it, but it would be a, you know, a fire sale basically. Or we could try this, or I could file bankruptcy and be done with it all or whatever. And we weren't really in a bankrupt state. We were just in a state of peril. It was one though, that we couldn't pay bills. We couldn't pay all of our bills. And, I just,
is it mainly Sandy, because of the $500,000 note that you guys were paying off, or was it the operations were floundering a little bit because of the gap that was missing?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, like, I want to be fair to my late husband. He was smart, and so were the employees, and he was dedicated. I think it was the typical scenario with a small business where the owner is there. The owner is very passionate. The owner knows a lot. You know, this was 20 years ago. So, you know, small companies, why do we need processes and procedures and things like that? So when the person is there all the time, they know what's going on. So when that person, thankfully we had time, like, he did teach his staff a lot of it, but, you know, we didn't really know what margins should be or some of those inner working details that we keep in our mind more than on paper for others to learn. So that was one of my first lessons, was even though it's a small company, how do we cross train and how do we start documenting even simple procedures? So that my main goal starting was that these employees, these dedicated employees, would never have this happen again if something were to happen to the owner now, meaning me, which was a great business model to build it off of.
Yeah,
I mean, reason, not because I was some genius. It's just, I don't want what happened to me to ever happen to anyone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, agreed. just I totally agree. And Sandy, give me some thoughts on like your mindset. Like when you said my goal, like, because I can imagine like this whole thing goes down. You got $500,000 of debt. You sell it. You probably go. Did you run some numbers to say, you know, I could pay off the debt if we, you know, did this right now, and then I could just continue living my life? Or like, so what did it, kind of maybe a two part question is like, what process did you go through to figure out that you wanted to keep it? And then what was your goal once you decided I want to keep it?
Mm-hmm. It was pretty rogue, to tell you the truth. So I still to this day would classify myself more as a visionary, utopian dreamer thinker. And sometimes you're either the visionary or you're more of the integrator detail person. And I learned both, thankfully. And so I have both sides. So I kind of went by what I could handle in a day's time, but really it was pretty rogue. You know, I didn't do budgets. I didn't know how to do budgets. You know, I didn't do projections. I didn't even know what they were at the time, really. But I had leadership roles. You know, it's just, I wasn't in those roles of the financial piece of it. And guess what? You figure that out really fast. So what did I do? I met with my accountant a lot. And by the way, if you're meeting with your accountant a lot, your business probably isn't doing good. And, you know, it's kind of like that ignorance is bliss thing. The nice part in hindsight was when you don't have a lot to lose, you can try.
Mm-hmm.
You always have that. And as long
as was that your mindset right off the bat? And I guess going back is because I guess what I'm trying to figure out, Sandy, is like did you go through a process of like, I want to maybe to look at selling this so I can continue living my life? Or was it like right off the bat, like you said, with your late husband, like, hey, I'm going to give this a shot from the very beginning. Like, what was your mindset before you committed to moving forward?
Yes. So my mindset was really, I mean, like, I'm trying to not put swear words in here.
Oh, the listeners are, it's okay. It's definitely okay.
I mean, it was kind of an oh shit thing. Like, you gotta be kidding me. Like, you know, not number one, I'm 30 and I just buried my, you know, new husband who is 33. You know, the community was interested and watching. Some of them were very giving and wanted to help, and others just wanted a good story, which I definitely was a good story. And in a small town, you already feel like you're kind of living in a fishbowl. But so I had a lot of critics of really, okay, this woman, this young woman who knows nothing about this business is going to come in and take it over a very, you know, male dominated business where she knows nothing about. Good luck. This should be interesting. And so I had a lot of emotions. Some of it was leave me alone. You know, let me try. Why is everybody working against me? And not everybody was, but that's how I felt at the time. But, you know, really I started. So I became very jaded, very internally, very jaded, lost. Actually, I was kind of desperate to fix it. So I wanted to fix it so I could sell it. That was the deal. And so that was my determination.
What was your time frame in your head between that decision to when you thought you were going to accomplish that goal?
Yeah. 6 months.
And it was 2003 to 2020, right? Am I getting that math right?
I'll give this 6 months. So it's like, okay, I can do this for 6 months. This is my 30-year-old mind. I'll do it for 6 months. And in 6 months, I'll have it fixed and then I'll sell it. You know, because his deal was if it doesn't work, sell it and move on. You know, or if something happens to me. Actually, really, we didn't even have a plan of what would happen if something happened to him. When he was going in for a bone marrow transplant, the night before, I'm like, you know what? We never had a chance to like talk about our financials or our financial picture too much. We kind of both had an idea. And I'm like, I need you to tell me what's going to happen if I don't bring you home with me. Oh, and so we had a sheet of paper that he wrote. Here's my bank account. Here's what I think you should do. And I'm sure I have that sheet somewhere. I haven't seen it in years, but it's probably stuck somewhere. And that was my one roadmap.
So he never came back out, huh? After that?
No, unfortunately, yeah, we were in the hospital for about 2.5 months and he actually died cancer-free, which is a common story. You die of the complications because your body is so depleted. He got pneumonia towards the end and ended up dying of the complications because your immune system is so depleted. So, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Wow. So 6 months, I think that a lot of people can relate to that, Sandy, of like, hey, here's this vision. It's only going to take me so long to get there. So I'm trying to think of how to word this. A lot of people are overestimate where they're at right now, and then they underestimate what they're actually capable of accomplishing long term. Mm-hmm. And so you ended up scaling up to, was it $8 million in revenue? So you didn't just keep it surviving. You actually like grew a healthy business that was thriving over the course of those years. And so like, as you're going in there and you said day to day and you're kind of getting your feet underneath you, did your mindset start to shift to say, okay, this is not just a 6 month gig. And then like, how were you judging what you were doing and what you should be focusing on while you were, while we were growing it?
So I have always, you know, and I honor this more and I'm unapologetic for it now. And I use it a lot in my coaching and consulting now. I always had an intuitive side and that can sound hokey and woo. And I really don't care.
It's okay. I lean in.
Yes. I think everyone has an intuitive side that I actually teach leaders and my coaching and consulting clients how to use it more, because when we match logic, like the logical decisions we make in our brain, so we make, you know, those business-based decisions and we check in and say, does this feel right? And can I see this vision? Can I feel the passion behind it? And when I always call it the infinity loop when I do consulting and coaching work, it's like when we can loop our mind with that logic, the logical mind with, can I feel this? Can I vision it? Can I see it? Mm-hmm. And does this make sense, you know, in my innateness or whatever you want to call it, in essence? That is where the magic happens. And so, I mean, the good story would be, I put all these processes and procedures and I learned how to do projections, which I did get really good at account, you know, like understanding financials and profit and loss. And I remember crunching all of our invoices on a 10-key calculator just to make sure we weren't missing anything, but it helped me understand having a business that was that in need of repair. And by the way, I did not do this myself. My employees helped me immensely, and so did a lot of other people. I don't know that I would have had a successful story now to share, Ryan, had it not been for those very humble, you know, jaded, broken beginning, whatever you want to say. This beautiful business that just needed some TLC. And so I think I used the passion and the heart of what we had there, like that conviction of, you know, legacy, but also like what we didn't have, like for me, was the know-how of how do I even feed these animals? Like I grew up on a farm, but I didn't really pay as much attention as some, but what we had was a passion for people. And, you know, like I can leverage relationships. And in hindsight, I figured out like that's what I was doing or what we were doing at the time. But like what we have is, you know, we can figure out a different model because I don't know what the old ways and the old paradigms are. Mm-hmm, and so I kind of questioned everything and built a new model. We actually started doing more of the gig economy 20 years ago.
Why don't you walk us through like, you know, how were the operations working? And as you said, you created a new model. Why don't you unpack that a little bit?
Yeah. So the joy that I had in it, and I didn't feel like it was joy at the time. I felt like it was another huge weight and burden, but the joy of not knowing a history is you can think about everything so differently, which I've always been unique in that way anyway, like this creative space of like, so I could question everything of like, well, okay, we don't have money to do it that way or to hire people. What's plan B?
Mm-hmm. Constraints are sometimes the best enabler for great ideas.
Yes. And so I thought, like, well, okay, we don't, we're broke, so we can't hire people. We don't really have any, you know, and I, we, again, thankfully we had great customers. So we did have a revenue stream. It's just our bills were much higher than our revenue stream. And so how can we grow our business and get the support we need without paying for it? Mm-hmm. That was the mystery, magical question. And so I'm like, well, okay. So we, our vendors are already helping us with, you know, nutrition work and so on. How could we get other people to help us like that? Like, how could we build this professional ecosystem to help support us where they would have some skin in the game? And that took a lot of management because you always had to keep protecting your middle space then. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we don't need a full-time accountant. You know, we don't need a full-time XYZ. I mean, just plug in the positions in a company that you usually need. So I ended up thinking about who could work for us on contract, you know, a marketing person or whatever. And I didn't know at the time, but it's kind of like that contractor model now. Like,
so you're just paying for hourly rates or something like that with people, or as you're working on the operations? Super interesting. Yes,
and leveraging relationships. So sometimes we didn't even pay, we just partnered.
So well, give us an example of that.
So actually that model was set up much, much long before I was there. Of, for example, the vendor companies where we were purchasing feed products, they provided the sales support. And so they provided it because if we sold their feed,
then
they would provide sales support to help us on the farms. And that worked really well. So we were in partnership with them quite a bit.
Super cool. So, hey, and as you, I mean, over 17 years as you're growing this, I mean, and going from $1 to $8 million, I mean, that's significant, Sandy, because I mean, if you look at the stats, I mean, you got it into the upper, you know, 5% of the people that get over 5 million. I think it's less than 5% of the companies get over 5 million bucks. So what were you, again, going back to the mindset, what were you solving for? Like what, like when you're trying to march towards like a point B, is it like, was it a revenue? Was it a sale? Was it like lifestyle business? Like what were you waking up and going, am I on track or off track? Or was it just more of just, you know, making sure that the day to day was taken care of?
Mm-hmm. I think it was both. So I was convicted that we had something great. And it, and what we had was, when I think back to, actually, it's fairly relevant to now, your employees, like I loved, you know, like, I mean, we didn't get along every day or whatever, but we got along pretty good, where it's like, we loved what we had built back. And we loved the legacy of what Randy, my late husband, had started. And I think that, you know, like, if you think about what cultures are looking for now is a place to belong, this sense of purpose, this passion. And really, we, I felt like we were, we built a company that was kind of like a warm hug. Like we really nurtured our customers because we loved our customers and we wanted to take care of them. And I think that's the longing that our world has now when they look at, where do I want to work? I want to feel like I belong. I want to feel like I matter. I want to feel like I'm heard and understood and that people really care. And that's not anything new, but I think that was kind of our sweet spot, was we kind of brought like this love for people in all we did. And we felt like we really felt like our goal was to take care of our customers better than anyone else. Mm-hmm. That's what we could do that was different.
So I love it because Sandy, there, we have these five principles called the intentional growth principles that we talk about. And the first one is your drivers, which is really getting into the heart of the soul of yourself and the business and what, like the things that you're talking about right now. And then the second principle is your financial targets, which is the lens of like, I want all these things, but I can't because I'm broke. Or like, you know, what are the financial implications of the things that I want? And in your, like you said, it's kind of that infinity loop that you're talking about where it's like, I want this, but then logically, can I get it? And so like balancing those two, I think is interesting to hear how people do that. And I was listening to your interview with Warlow and you were talking about how you always would entertain some conversations with people. And so like, how are you, you know, as you are so passionate about the business, but you all, from what I understood from that interview, you were talking about, hey, I've got I'm willing to have conversations about selling this business still. Mm-hmm. What did that mean to you of like selling a business? Like, did you have an idea of what that would mean to your employees, your vendors, the different people, or was it just like a dollar amount, like pay off the debt? Well, I'm assuming you paid it all off over a handful of the first years, but like, how did you balance like the emotional things of what you wanted and the financials? And then when you're mm-hmm. entertaining these discussions or thoughts?
Yes. Excellent question. I don't know that I balanced it very well. You know, because your business is your baby. And I would say there have been many gifts of what you learn when you experience tragedy so young. So the fact that I thought that I should sell a business within 6 months, put that mindset of you should always build a business for sale. Mm-hmm. You know, like, and I think that's a good model of, even if I want to keep it, the question should always be, what would make this business so valuable that somebody might buy it someday? And so whether I keep a business or I don't, it was a great mindset to have. So like, how do we stay on the edge? Because we really were the David in the David and Goliath picture mm-hmm. where we were even, I never thought of myself. So I think also being very humble, like I was very proud of what we had. And I say we, because you have to learn leadership and think through.
I've noticed many times already in this conversation, you've corrected every once in a while when you say I, you go back to we, which is very interesting, because there's a lot of people that'll come on the show and they'll say, I built this, I did this. Yeah, and so it's not everybody. I mean, it's a unique thing.
And I think we can honor the hard work that a leader does, or that the owner mm-hmm. does. You know, those 3 a.m. in the morning of, oh man, how are we going to overcome that?
Payroll, inventory.
Yeah. So those sleepless nights. And I put myself up to learning fast. And I'm still like that, just like this knowledge acquisition person. So I think the joy of, a gift really of what tragedy does when you experience it young is it makes you brave. And it also puts context on your side of what life is really about. And so sometimes, you know, when I look back now, I really think it was a series of just saying yes to the path that I've gotten to now of, yes, I'll take over this business. Yes, it's in financial turmoil, but it's got a great base, mm-hmm. great employees, great customers, a great ecosystem kind of. And it also makes you brave to say yes to some of the opportunities that came, and say yes to really challenging conversations where I had to defend our space in the market and say, hey, we mean business here. Mm-hmm. You know, I might not look like all of you right now, you know, like the mostly...
You can just say it. Yeah.
Like, I'm not a male basher at all, but like, I mean, it was mostly, I just wanted factually.
You came from the farming industry, Sandy.
There were people that did not want me to participate. And so I used to be so defensive on that. Like, wow, just can't you see me for what I can do? And then I just kind of gave up. I'm like, you know what, Sandy, it's kind of like that heart to heart you have internally. You can't be mad every day, because that's just ruining your life. So why don't you just do good work.
That's awesome.
And do good for people, and have a mystique about that. Like, just like, work with people that want to work with you, and give them something good to think about, instead of always like, yeah, that's not really the true story. I mean, oh my gosh, that just takes so much energy. So, to go back to your question and answer it succinctly, I always felt like a business should be for sale. And I still live by that, because whether you want to keep a business or not, how do I make it valuable to someone else?
Mm-hmm. And so, and I want to make sure we also get into kind of the spinoff that you also still have, and like how the operational strategies were changing. But I want to stay on this mindset and the thought process for a second, Sandy, because it's so interesting to me over the years that I've been doing this show, is like, so many people say, I want out, or I'm going to sell. But they do not specify what they mean by like out. Do you mean your job or this financial asset that kicks out a bunch of cash? Mm-hmm. And because like, and again, we spend a lot of time, and I've been gotten very passionate about it from my old story, is you could sell your asset and still be the leader of the company if you did an ESOP, or you did some sort of, you know, management buyout. So you, that's a different way of monetizing your asset and keep running the business and having the impact and fun that you want. You might get a little bit less money than selling it to a strategic buyer, but you decided you wanted to do that for various reasons, or selling it. I think so many people, they tune into like Built to Sell, or they talk about exit planning. It's like, I'm selling this to a competitor. They're going to gut the company and they're going to take my clients and I'm going to walk away with a bag of cash and I have no job. But there's a thousand million different options of combinations to not have to go that route. And so like when I'm going back to your mindset, like when you thought of selling it, was it the people, because you kept mentioning David and Goliath, you had a lot of big players. Did you, did you have like certain players in your head? You're like, this is going to be a natural fit. And like, this is always going to make sense. It's just a matter of time before they knock on the door. Or where did those conversations start happening? And what did you think of when you thought of the word sell or exit?
Mm-hmm. So I did have, I did have some vendors in mind that, really, if I were them, I would just, if we're being a little disruptive to them, and this was, 10 years ago, long before I ever sold, they easily could take me out. And my idea of sell was, I want to build a company where the owner can get plucked out, the owner meaning me, because in studying business, I think it's good to be self-aware. And a lot of times the owner doesn't always do well staying. Unless you say, I'm fine running this company as the president, which is a very different feel than being the owner. A lot of people don't do well in the earnout process. Some do, some are fine, like fine, I'll stay 2 years. It feels very different though for many. And I know this just from my coaching clients and so on that are business owners or former business owners trying to start something new. It's very different. I mean, there's this almost romanticism around, I sell and then I'm free. Well, when people sell and stay, when the owner sells and stays in the company, you're not necessarily free anymore. You've got a new boss.
Well, so, you still have, and that's kind of going back to what I was saying. You're separating, I have an asset over here that I can monetize when and however, and then I've got a job. And most of the time, my experience is people say, I want to sell because I want out. They actually want out of their job. They don't necessarily want out of their financial asset.
Yes.
And so like to your point, like even by selling, you're like, you didn't get what you originally wanted, which is not to have to go to work and have all the stress. You still have all the stress and it's now dependent upon some other organization.
Yes. Yes. And they want out of, usually they want out of a lot of the feelings that people are experiencing right now.
Yes.
Burnout, overwhelm, stress. Why do I do this? There's got to be a better, lifestyle than this, all of that. And so the actual process of going through that and then after doesn't always feel that beautiful.
Yes.
So, yes. Because one of my colleagues who also sold his company some time ago said, Sandy, you're going to go through a hangover when you sell your company. And I think he's right some will say, oh, what have I done? I shouldn't have done that or whatever. But like you go through this emotional, journey of, I feel good about it. I miss my employees. What do I miss the most is the people, employees, customers, community, things like that. So
I called it phantom anxiety, Sandy. I got done. I was like, I literally have no one reaching out to me. I'm not needed anywhere. And like, who am I? Like, it was just this very bizarre.
Yes.
And
yes.
So go ahead.
And I had set myself up. So I was pretty self-aware of, okay, Sandy, if you ever do sell, what would your landing net be? Cause some people will, just rip the Band-Aid and see where they fall. And for me, I knew I needed some sort of security blanket before that would happen. But, long before I sold, actually 15 years ago, probably more than that, I started speaking because I was asked to speak. It was another one of those say yes and figure it out, to share my message in business. And you actually 2008, 2009, when the economy crashed, people were like, can you come and talk to our, be a keynote and talk to this conference about turnaround in the midst of chaos. And you know, how did you nurture your people and all that? And I didn't even classify myself as having turned around a company. You know, I was just doing what I thought I should. So that's how I started speaking. So then I had that dynamic. And then people would ask me to, you know, coach or consult them on how to turn around their company. So I'm like, sure, you know, can you send me a proposal? Sure. And then you're driving home, like, guess I better make up.
How much am I going to charge this person?
I guess I'm coaching now. So, yeah. And so that's how it all started. But I needed something to fall back on so that I wasn't dead in the water.
So very helpful for some context. Why did you decide to sell instead of replacing yourself as the president, GM, and then keeping it as an asset? And the mm-hmm. and the reason I think it's very interesting that you decided to sell to a third party like this is because you built everything about your mindset and building processes and procedures and all that stuff. You were having the right mindset where that could have actually potentially been an option from what it sounds like. We're mm-hmm. stepping back where a lot of people, they think about it, but it's more of a dream than it is actually about mm-hmm. possibility. So why go the route of selling to a third party instead of just replacing someone? And then you got another venture and you got other things that you're doing. So you could have just kept it as a financial asset.
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. And it does work sometimes for the owner to, you know, become more silent. So I had tried that is the answer where, and actually when our vendor partner ended up coming to me and saying, are you ready to sell? Because we were working together on a lot of farms at that point. When the pandemic hit, I went and that was the first time that I worked from home. And I had previous to that for a few months, the goal for 2020 was to hire a few fractional type leaders mm-hmm. so that I could work on this new entity that we had created, the Feed with Essential Oils. And that was meant to, we did that and we can talk about that or not. We created a new brand within our company to be into a different space and kind of be more autonomous. And so I had hired a fractional leader to help lead the company. And I also hired a fractional salesperson that was very experienced and knew our customers to come in and help with the traditional mm-hmm. side of the business so that I could work on this new part. And so that worked, except I think it really depends on the owner. I felt really disconnected to the people and it was a pandemic too. So it was just really obviously online. But I'm like, now, you know, what I loved was the people. And so now all I'm working on is the business, which I also love building business, but without the people and the, you know, the emotional attachment part of the passion, it was becoming something that felt very different for me.
Which I appreciate your response. And I think a lot of people struggle with that because I find it so fascinating, Sandy. And I'm going to walk you through just a couple of my observations, is that like, even people that like are in our CFO clients who build like very sustainable like plans and metrics and like they can work themselves out, they still can't. There's this client of mine I'm thinking of specifically. She just like she's built a machine. She barely has to go into the office, but she runs a bunch of triathlons and a bunch of things. And she still thinks about it while she's swimming or running or, you know, biking or whatever. So she can't stop thinking about it, even though she's not needed. And it's like, I can almost guarantee you that if you were to say to her, hey, you're going to invest and own 70% of this, I'm going to make it a plumbing company, she'd go, okay, and have zero issue, you know, calling in on a monthly board meeting. And I don't know if it's because people create it and then they can't stop thinking about it and versus like treating it just as an investment. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, because like it's because hypothetically, well, not hypothetically, like right now you still don't have the people. So no matter what, you went the route of not being part of the people, which is what you decided that you really liked mm-hmm. about it.
Right. And on top of that, well, number one, I was not seeking to sell the company back in 2020. I actually had doubled down to build this new brand out. It's called.
Why don't you walk through why you did it and what it is?
Yes. So probably about, maybe 2017, 2018, we were doing well. you know, we had good years and so on. And agribusiness, just like a lot of other industries, it was changing fast. And so we had sizable farms. We went everything from selling dog food and bird seed to having sizable farms of 1,000 cows and so on, beef or dairy.
Yeah.
And so it was no secret that these, especially the larger farms, were going to go direct. Like, they did not need the local feed dealer, retailer anymore, and likely would move direct because everything was going larger. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they would just figure out a way to skip us and go right to our vendor. And our vendor was telling us this too. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't a secret to me, but I guess my stubbornness or conviction or whatever you want to call it is like, well, we're just going to draw the line.
We're going to plow through David and Goliath, right?
A lot of these farms came to our vendor because we nurtured the relationship first. So I'm like, we brought this to you. So like, I mean, I would fight for my spot, in a business type way. And, but I knew that the writing was on the wall, that we were going to have to shift our business model tremendously, because the larger farms would likely not be ours anymore at some point. And had already happened on a few. And so we had a come to Jesus meeting, for the lack of a better way to say it, where we were working with, one of our consultants at the time who helped us with strategy and so on. And I had prepped him and I said, I'm at zero. I'm so burnt out. You know, this is where a lot of leaders and owners are now. I think my employees don't even have a clue, but I can see the writing on the wall. Like, we're going to lose a lot of our farms because they'll have to, well, and the other thing that was happening, a lot of farms were just quitting. Like, we lost a lot of farms just because they quit farming because of prices being so low for so long.
And so I want to ask a clarifying question. When you say that you're just burnt out and you're at zero, from what I'm gathering is you were burnt out and you're at zero for seeing the opportunity in the business strategically in the marketplace, or was it also the job of grinding away, or was it maybe both?
Mm-hmm. I think both. I mean, I could see the future that agribusiness was changing fast and it was going to be, it always was like, how do we stay relevant as a young, you know, like a small company mm-hmm. amongst the big players? And, you know, you do that through people, you know, mostly. But we didn't have anything. We didn't have anything unique to us. We resold other companies' products and so on. And so I prepped the facilitator of our meeting and I said, this is getting more and more difficult and I'm on burnout. My energy is just depleted. I can see that if we don't change dramatically one more time, because we had to over time, obviously. I said, I don't know, something's got to give here. Either we close while we're on top or we do something different. And so he goes, well, that's what we'll present. There was two other key staff in the meeting of, here's where we're at. We either double down and we create a whole nother dynamic to our business so that we become more autonomous, which likely meant going and, you know, moving away from some of our big vendors that had mm-hmm. a lot of too much, in my opinion. They were great to work with. They just, they had too much of our business, which gave them too much power. So we either create a new dynamic to our company and work with other partners, new partners, or we close while we're on top.
Close meaning?
Close, like collect accounts receivable, close the business, just be done.
You actually thought about closing instead of selling?
Financial standing. So like I could, you know, gratefully, we went from being very broke to a few years later. Like it actually did happen. And I was in pretty, I think it's really, to back up, I think it's really, really important to have a prize for, you know, like something. I'm a visionary. So it's like, what vision can I have for when this gets better? How does that look and feel when this gets better? And back then when things were so bad in the beginning, I'm like, I always had this rogue hippie side. And I'm like, I am going to buy myself a Harley if I can ever write a check.
That's awesome.
And so I did a year and a half later and it was a big one. It wasn't the Sportster that a lot of women and oh my gosh, that day was free. But so we had this come to Jesus of, either, you know, and I what I needed from that meeting was, how convicted are my two other key employees to keep this going? In my heart, I'm like, gosh, it doesn't feel like, again, going back to that intuitive nudge, I don't feel like we should be done, but we can't keep going like this because we're just losing customers. They're quitting farming altogether and getting jobs where they can actually make money. And the big ones are going to go away. And that's just the facts. And so,
did you, and you really like considered shutting it down versus selling? I mean, cause going back, you know, decades before, your thought was build something to sell it. So did you think about selling it, or was it more
Yes. Mm-hmm. I'd had, and I even asked a few vendors, you know, back at those times, just kind of in a conversation of, are you interested? And their answer was always, we don't really buy retailers, because usually what happens in a business like ours is, you know, and it was no different. I saw it happen to other businesses in our area of, you shut down, we take your customers. We pay nothing. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. like the feed mill in the next town. Okay, we hear they're shutting. Let's go after their customers.
Well, and so many times the retail business owners in general, the building that they may or may not have bought at some point is worth five times as much as the actual company.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I mean, the model, what was happening for small players like us is that you shut down, we don't pay a dime, we go after your customers, we see what we can get. So it really, because we had nothing proprietary, that would have been fairly easy.
It would have been to you, but you had healthy cash flow, I'm assuming, on an $8 million in revenue. And I don't know what the numbers were, but like, so when mm-hmm. you're sitting there with your executive team, what was the result of doubling down versus shutting down?
Yes.
Is that what was the,
Yes. So I said, I am in if you two are in, you know, and because they were the two, you know, pivotal people, mm-hmm. and not that nobody else was in our company, because we needed all of us, but those were the two that held the customer relationships most. And I'm like, I have some ideas and it's going to be hard work, but if you are in and committed, I won't quit either. So that's what we decided.
That's what spun off the e-commerce.
Yeah. And so, you know, before this, I had kind of like, gosh, we either need to figure something out. And I think like this is why I love coaching, because I love seeing nearby lanes, and I think it's easy, or like, you know, it's kind of like you're too close to your own company. So like, mm-hmm. but like me being a visionary and a dreamer, I'm like, what about this? What about this? And I remember going on a retreat before this meeting, and the whole idea of the retreat was, and it was kind of like this woo, you know, I don't know, we did yoga and things like that, and massage, and a woman's retreat. And it was a weekend up in northern Minnesota. And my goal was figure out what I'm going to do with this company and get a new idea. And so on the massage table, you know, we had just done like this essential oils blending class.
Oh,
and
nice.
You know, I was using peppermint, you know, for colds and things like that before that. So this was, you know, at least 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago, whatever. And we had done this essential oils blending class, and all of these ladies that were in this retreat were like spending hundreds and hundreds of dollars to like make these lotions and blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, yeah, this is something. And I was into it too, because I had them in my house and stuff, but kind of realized. So then I go on to get a massage right after that. And I'm like, the goal of my massage is to come up with an idea. And so I remember laying face down the massage table going, why wouldn't we put essential oils in feed? You know, and back then, I mean,
and I know that's what everybody thinks about while they're getting a massage,
yes.
right? I love it. True entrepreneur fashion. I love it.
Of course. You know, and, you know, so like then after massage, I go and get my phone and I look it up, and nobody was doing it yet. And surely, you know, Cargill and all the big players were thinking of it, and, you know, in product, you know, some sort of product mm-hmm. concept formulation on it, because everything was moving to all natural and things like that. And so that's the avenue I went down is. And so like the goal was, I told my two staff, I'm like, I think we can figure out how to put essential oils in feed. And And so dairy and farming and traditional agribusiness wasn't doing good at the time at all. That was an understatement. It was tanking fast. And so I'm like, my goal was, I want to sell chicken feed with essential oils to backyard and urban chicken people.
Mm-hmm.
And so like, I'm like, if I can figure out how to sell a bag of essential oil based chicken feed to people in Sacramento, California, that's, you know, so like mm-hmm. an e-commerce model, more or less.
Well, direct to consumer, instead of going through. And like you said, you were always worried about the big players who are consolidating rapidly, bypassing you, right?
Yes. And so selling to people that had this disposable income and were into wellness. I did have a wellness hippie side anyway. So I'm like, well, why don't we give people stuff for their animals that they would want for themselves? So that's what we did. And it wasn't that easy, but.
Well, and it's a completely different business model and a different target market, but also makes sense with the pivot based on the pressures coming on your normal business. Where did that, with the normal business then, what precipitated the conversations to actually sell it instead of shut it down?
Yeah, so we started with chicken feed. I found a different milling partner and we milled chicken created recipes with, and actually it wasn't like a dab of, you know, this sort of oil and that sort of oil. I found a company that had a dried blend product that was tested and proven, that was used as an ingredient in feed. And so I found a company that did that and I just, you know, partnered with them to put those sort of blends in our feed. And so the milling partner helped me with the recipe. We included the essential oils proven blend. So it wasn't some hokey woo type of thing at all. It was proven. And we started with chicken feed and then the hustle began. And when the chicken feed started taking off, some of these farmers were like, well, can you make me a goat feed? Can you make me a rabbit feed? And then it went into mainstream, like what I would consider. So this was hobby and, mm-hmm. you know, specialty more first. And then some of our customers, because we had mostly farm type customers, they're like, well, could you put that in beef feed? And we made a beef feed. And I still kind of fall off my chair thinking that traditional Midwest farmers had essential oil based beef feed in their bins. But guess what? It worked. You know, like we have to be very careful about health claims because it's not, you know, proven scientific. Yep. But what people were seeing was less medication used. Oh, wow. The animals were growing faster, even chickens. You know, like they had to medicate less.
Science.
In Egyptian times to embalm mummies. Like this is not new stuff. There's a lot of medicinal type value in this stuff. Mm-hmm. So as this is
taking off, did someone knock on your door then for the main business that you were still not very sure what you wanted to do with?
Yes. So when we went into beef, we started being, you know, so like our vendors that we were working with, what I told my staff was we have to maintain the working relationships we have with our current vendors while we create something disruptive of our own.
Yep.
Which isn't a beautiful story. You know, it's not
fun. You don't want everybody to really, you don't want to flaunt that in front of everybody.
So what I did was I actually told our vendors what we were going to do. And actually in my mind, they could actually mill it for us if they want, but they were busy doing their own thing respectfully. And so I kind of told them at the forefront, this is what we're up to. And we proceeded to do it. And it ended up getting a little disruptive to them because we weren't bringing new customers there. We were putting them on our own feed, which was the intention because we wanted to be more autonomous. And so when we went into dairy, started doing like bulk dairy feed on some of the farms. And then we created then some of our customers saw how well it was working in the beef. So then they asked us to do like, kind of like, they call it like a top dress. It's kind of like putting herbs on top of your scrambled eggs or whatever.
Okay. Yeah.
And so they asked us to do some sort of ingredient that they could put in their dairy for their dairy cows. So that for their milking cows. And we created like an ad pack kind of where they could dump it into their mix and mix it and put it on, put it with their dairy feeds. And we, what we found was, you know, calves, calf feed became a big seller. Like calves were transitioning better off of milk and onto feed and, you know, growing at a faster clip, which is what we want, and healthier naturally. And then dairy, the cows were transitioning out of, you know, like calving easier and things like that. So when we started doing more of the mainstream agribusiness stuff, then our vendor came to me. I still remember it was a Monday morning, their broker called and just said, hey, have you ever thought about, I mean, are you ready to have a conversation about maybe selling your business? And going back to the roots of your business should always be for sale, Sandy. I said, I'm always willing to entertain a conversation. So that's how that started. Yeah.
So then, and what was the, like the process that you took? I mean, were they the ones that you sold to? Did you hire a representative on your side to help facilitate the conversations or?
Yeah. So those were things I had considered. And in this case, again, going back to like gut instinct and what do I need? This was a vendor that we had worked with the whole time I was at. Egg Venture was the name of the company. So we were already really familiar with each other. I didn't have to do a lot of due diligence on the company. I knew the management. I knew the staff. I mean, I was always working with them. Mm-hmm. And so were all of us. And so, you know, we met for lunch a few times and what I said first was, I don't think this is a good time to sell my company because I'm doubling down. I'm using the profits from what we have at Egg Venture to build out this new company, New Heritage. And so if we're looking at, you know, EBITDA, it's not going to look good right now because I am, you know, I'm purposefully doubling down. So this isn't a great time to sell. And so
can I interrupt you for a second? So Technically, like, so if you guys actually did like a normalized or adjusted EBITDA, that wouldn't be considered part of it. So you should have still been able to see what the cash flow is doing without that. That was just your choice of what to do with the money afterwards. Right. So is that how it all kind of,
yes,
did you get to that point at some point? Mm-hmm.
Yes. And for years before that, I would always make, I called it an adjusted income statement. Mm-hmm. Just, you know,
adjusted EBITDA for the most part, right?
Yeah, pretty much. And so, but I always kept that because like, what would my company have done had we not had year-end spending, mm-hmm. you know, if we wouldn't. So I had done that for years, which helped me a lot actually in this case. And so I had those numbers fairly readily available. Like what would we have done financially had I not use some of this money to put it into the new company's efforts. And so, and then I went to Harvard for a negotiations class, which really helped me, you know, a few years earlier.
That's awesome.
No matter, I wanted to sell because I could see that it was changing and I wasn't short-sighted enough to sell just because I wanted to. Like you kind of have to stay committed heart and soul, no matter what. And so, I wanted to sell, but my story was, and it was true. It was like, I don't know if this is a good time. I think we're just getting going on this new side. That's kind of exciting. Mm-hmm. And so like, I mean, because I wanted to obviously capture as much as I could too. And so, I mean, and that was a truthful thing. Like I kind of wanted to sell at the heart of hearts. However, let's be honest, this isn't a great time, even with the adjusted in there. Because, you know, we had lost some business due to people.
I want to unpack that because, you know, I don't know what the time duration was between like that management strategy conversation, doubling down to the e-commerce. I mean, at one point you were deciding, should we just shut this down and collect the receivables? Yeah. Now someone's actually willing to pay you for it. What was your mindset of like, or thought perception of what it was worth? I mean, you don't have to give any numbers, but just like, right. Did you guys have any discussions around value and how they would value it? And did they also want the other part of the business or was it just the original?
So just to give you a time frame, it was probably about a year after we really got going. So it kind of did happen
pretty fast. Yeah.
Contextually fairly fast, or year and a half at most. And so I knew what my business was kind of worth. I mean, just from being in consulting and coaching on the side for so long, it's like what you wish your company was worth is so much different than what somebody will actually pay you. And so I had that. I mean, I always kept track of my financials pretty good. And I mean, I could see like, okay, if agribusiness is paying a multiple of 4 or 5, this is what it's going to be. Okay. So let's just be real, Sandy. And so actually we started conversations, I believe in May or June of 2020. And this is what I told them. I'm willing to work with you. This is probably a good idea. I can see that, even though this is hard on me, because this was, you know, my late husband's legacy.
Oh, I'm sure that just trolled up, yes, a bunch of emotions.
And, you know, and obviously the hard part for me was we were always such a people-oriented business that it was hard for me to do this and not tell my employees. And so what I said to the vendors is, we already work together. So if this can go quick, if this can be friendly, and if you treat my, you know, they're not really my employees. Like, I always think they're mine, 'cause like you care about them. But, if you treat the employees well, those are the, and then the fourth thing was, please don't tell me what you're going to do after you sell or after
why didn't you want to know?
Because I mean, even we didn't need our location that much anymore, besides like the hobby farm people that would come in. Most of our business was done on the farm. So I kind of knew that they'd likely shut down our beloved space. And I just didn't want, I mean, we had a great small town feel and we did a lot for our community. So I just didn't want to, I kind of knew what they would do, but I didn't want to know, type of thing. So I'm like, don't tell me what you're going to do after. And
did you think about getting other buyers involved, or because of that reason right there, Sandy, did you think about exploring other ways to monetize the business to protect that aspect of the business?
Yes, I did. And actually I had explored that over time of like who else could be a partner. I had asked my employees even a few times throughout the years, like, are you interested in taking this over? And, you know, they had expressed like, I like what I'm doing now, but not really, you know, like,
I like you having the responsibility and the risk, Sandy.
Yeah. So like I had asked around, and okay, actually even a few years before that, I had put it out to a broker, okay, for maybe 6 months to see, and, you know, and it's just wasn't that sellable of a company, to tell you the truth, because somebody could take us out so easily.
Well, and thank you, so helpful, because again, getting into the mindset of like, you know, just selling to the first person, you had a lot of context prior to that conversation that put it into perspective is what I'm, mm-hmm, gathering.
So yes, then, absolutely. And I had just I always was putting feelers out. I'm a questions asker. I'm curious, you know, and if people don't want us or me or whatever, well, then figure out how they might.
Mm-hmm. 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 So you end up selling because of what you had been building over the years from processes and infrastructure, did you have to stay on, or like, what was, you don't have to give any numbers, but how was the deal structure? Was, mm-hmm, there a certain amount of money up front? Was there any earnouts?
Yes. Or? Well, yes. It was fairly simple. So the biggest negotiation was what was going to happen with New Heritage, this new company, New Heritage. Mm-hmm. And I had split it out as a separate S corp probably 6 months prior, and they really didn't want that. They just wanted like the customers, and, mm-hmm, I mean, we're working together. So like, if they just take my piece out of it, they could capture the whole customer, and some of the employees were really good too. So they're like, well, we're really not interested in the New Heritage part, because that's like e-commerce and hobby and blah, blah, mm-hmm, blah. They wanted the traditional feed part. And so the biggest negotiating point was what to do with New Heritage. 'Cause I'm like, if you're going to shackle my ankles so that I can't grow this company, mm-hmm, then I'm not interested. You know, then everything I've put into this is all for naught. So that was the biggest piece. And the other piece was, I mean, they came back with an offer that was way lower than, you know, I mean, there was a strategy, right? It wasn't anything personal, but, and I said, you know, this really isn't going to capture the future value of what I'm building right now. So there was one point that I'm like, I just
don't think, and that value was on the New Heritage side, or yeah, the overall, yeah, the overall thing.
You know, like what New Heritage, what this new brand could do for Ag Venture.
Yep.
You know, because we were selling a lot of the New Heritage products within there. I'm like, you know, we're just starting to have fun with this now. So yep, like yep, the future value, like I knew that if I sold, that would just be cut off because yeah, most right, of our sales were through Ag Venture. So I knew that if I did this, I would be kind of disrupting the new company temporarily, at least. And that's exactly what happened.
So how did the negotiations with the traditional business go? And then a couple of questions. Did you feel like you got fair value for it? And then how, what was the final negotiation that you guys landed on, so, how to deal with it?
Fast forward to the end. They bought Ag Venture. New Heritage was still mine. What we did was they, you know, they bought everything kind of like turnkey. Well, it, not kind of like, it was. It was turnkey.
In what way?
We'll take care of, you know, the building. I mean, I didn't have to, all I had to move out was my, any personal stuff I had in there.
Whoa. Wow.
And so there, you know, and I remember one of the negotiation team people saying to me, Sandy, we don't mean this, you know, in a personal way, but we really don't need you after the sale.
And you're just like, double thumbs up. That's the whole point.
Kind of, but it is kind of like a dig too, you know, like
emotionally.
I was the owner of the company for 18 years, but then I reminded myself, Sandy, remember, this is exactly what you wanted to set up was, you know, like being plucked out. And so the reason they didn't need me was because my amazing employees, I had them running the day to day and they already were familiar with, the company buying us was already familiar with all of my staff because we had worked together. So that made it a lot easier. But the processes in place helped a lot, obviously.
Did that translate into an advantageous deal structure where more cash up front than because you didn't need to stick around?
Yes. I mean, an owner never feels like they got what they want, right? Like what they thought they could have. So how we structured it was they paid out everything right in the beginning. And then I'm like, you know, we have these great customers. And I think because we're so tied to our customers, you're going to be able to capture a lot of them in this sale process. And so I kind of, you know, like we worked hard for this. And so what happened was we put together a deal structure that they paid out kind of what the company was worth on the financial picture side, which was not a lot extra. And then a 3-year payment for customers they kept.
Mm-hmm.
So once a year for 3 years, whatever. So like I was gambling that they could keep a lot of the customers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I thought they probably could because we were already working together on some of those farms. Mm-hmm. And so I mean, that's not like this big windfall that comes to me, but it's part of the payment of if we were successful keeping the customers, then I get a check for whatever customers they kept, a small percentage of the customers they kept every year.
So I want to go now, because just for time purposes, is you had mentioned that, I can't remember what you said, the hangover effect of like reinventing yourself. You know, you're doing this coaching, you've got, is it Horizon or New, what's the new name?
New Heritage,
New Heritage with the e-commerce. You got other things to keep you focused. How did you process with your late husband? I mean, like there must have been a lot of emotional stuff going on in your head. And how did you process that and how have you been over the course of the last couple of years?
Yes. Well, I've always believed in managing through your emotions instead of, you know, like pushing them off. And so I would let them bubble up, but really it was kind of like grieving my late husband dying all over again in some regard, because everything came back up. And I would say that I did well for the most part, but I definitely went through a period of internal grieving again, because these people were my life for 18 years and I loved what we had built. And I love the essence. I mean, our goal when for our staff or, you know, our literal location was when people would enter they would leave happier.
That's awesome.
You know, and I mean, that's what we wanted to do. And so I really missed the people side, and it was like the Band-Aid had been ripped. Because you go from being this very people-centric company to you can't really even contact them so much. And I had a few customers reach out and say, good for you. But for the most part, it was just ripping the Band-Aid of, boom, who am I now?
Are you satisfied with how it all went down, or?
Yes. I mean, the one thing that I would have changed is because of COVID, I wasn't in the office a lot, which I was very... Like I already was missing, you know, learning about my employees' family and what they're up to and what their kids were up to and, you know, being involved like that. And so it was, to me, it was like because of COVID and COVID, because we weren't working together in person anymore. And then also the fact that you just can't tell your staff what you're up to when you're selling your company. That was really, I wish that could have been different. Mm-hmm. You know, like that was really a cold process in my mind of, you know, all of a sudden now I come back in and I tell them that I sold. And by the way, I'm not going to be here after Friday. And then boom, it's done. It just felt like that's not what I loved. Like, I mean, that's not how I would have done it. And I wish I could have done it different, but I'm not sure how. Yeah, I mean, that's just kind of the fallout of some of it. So
yeah, especially with the unique circumstances of COVID and a lot of interesting pressures leading you to that decision. So this is, you know, one last question before we get into the final two wrap up questions. But you know, what do you have for the hopes with the current business that you've got and your coaching? Like, how do you see the next chapter of your life unfolding?
Yes. Well, and so then, you know, to me, it's like spend time, you know, in your nest of grieving or whatever and get through all that. I am very grateful now. Like I still think about the employees we had there a lot, and I hope they're doing well and they're all doing great. They got hired by the new company. Some of them are hired, and I'm just really proud of them. And I feel like we nurtured some really good people. So like, I'm happy for them, and I do miss them still. And I miss our customers. But beyond that, I'm super grateful. And I have, so like I use, you know, like my coaching clients, I enjoy the life out of them because I get to help them build their company or rebuild or do strategic planning based on everything I did, you know, like everything I did well. And by the way, let's skip everything I did wrong. And not that I've got it all figured out, but me being this visionary, I think it's beautiful space now. Like, how do we reinvent our company? How do we make it come alive again? I work with a lot of leaders of, you know, what other dynamics am I not seeing that we could take our business from, you know, where it is now to like much more grand without like putting these old paradigms of, you know, the grind in there. Like, how could I be free and build this larger company or whatever? So I love that intersection. So I'm just grateful for that. And then New Heritage, I actually decided to put it on a pause because I'm like, I miss my team. I can't do this without a team. What am I going to do? And I it wasn't feeling good for me. And that's where I think you really need to honor stuff. It's like, okay, I've got something here. I don't think it's, you know, for death of a company yet. I really feel like I need strategic partners and a new team in order to make this happen. I feel this time I'm the founder. You know, I could be a visionary. I can help a team. I can speak on a stage because I'm already used to speaking on stages about business and all of this stuff. And, you know, transformational leadership is a big thing. And I, you know, even some of the sustainability and it's all like very relevant now, but I need a team. And so I'm like, there's some strategic investor that might come along that they do teams and I'd be happy to help them with it, but it's not for me to lead by myself. And so I kind of put it on pause. And actually, interestingly, right now I do have a strategic partner that's interested, and we just started working together a few weeks ago.
Super cool.
To like bring some test products to market again. And we have some great vision for it. So stay tuned.
That's awesome. So Sandy, the last two questions I have, one is the word intentional. Love the name. I love the word. It's the name of the podcast. And I like hearing what people think that the word means. So what does the word intentional mean for you?
You know what? I was thinking of that, Ryan, while we were talking. And I think every part of how we live and work, and actually our entire conversation, was what intention do I have behind everything I'm doing?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like that intention is like, if we can live by that intention, like if we figure out what our intention is first in every area of our life, we are going to solve a lot of our own problems, right?
Yes.
Like if our passion is aligned with our logic, that's intention.
Ooh, you know, I like that.
Use our intuitive nudges as great information for how we lead, how we build, what new, you know, paradigms can we put in place. That's intention.
I love it.
And
I
so it. Isn't intention the base of everything we do? And when we've got that intention, that base right, it's literal magic what I see a company can evolve to, and in quick order. I believe in quantum leaps. And so I'm very intentional about, you know, putting that, you know, I don't know what you want to call it.
Energy and effort into that journey.
Like, how can we quantum leap instead of going through this tedious process of 6 to 12 months before we see anything? So I'm all about putting a really grand intention into everything, because that is how we can alchemize really quickly.
Love it. Then where can people find more about you, learn about your coaching, and what's the best place to get in touch with you?
Yeah. So I have a website. It's my name, sandyhansenwolf.com. Hansen is spelled H-A-N-S-E-N, Wolf, W-O-L-F-F.com. Sandy at sandyhansenwolf.com. LinkedIn, same thing under my name. I'd love to talk. I love helping other people build brilliant, beautiful companies where they flourish.
Sandy, this has been a blast, and I'm so appreciative of you coming on and sharing this story.
My pleasure. I just love elevating people, getting them out of, you know, whatever situation they're in, and helping brilliant people ignite and come back to life. So thank you. It's been a humble privilege.
What an amazing story. I'm so happy Sandy was able to share that with everybody. If there's one takeaway that I have, is one is that, you know, just knowing that we all have a finite life. I mean, I think it helps put things into perspective, because, you know, putting your head in the sand, realize, you know, pretending that nothing's going to happen to us, or that, you know, life's going to go perfectly as planned, I think is something we all want, but it's completely unrealistic. And the only way that I can see that helps deal with the fact that life is chaotic and we don't necessarily have any control over our future is to have a very clearly defined plan, and how you can use your plan as a framework for decision making. And the only thing I would suggest is go check out the intentional growth training, because the whole point is, if you understand what your company's worth today, what you want it to be worth in the future, and then you're charting that path and you're making the trade-offs and the decisions along the way, it allows you to synthesize and handle the random out of the blue offers, you know, some sort of, you know, health event like Sandy's late husband had, like all of those random things that happen in life and business. You can put that into your plan and say, what do I want to do about this? So go check out the intentional growth training at arcona.io. And don't forget to look out for episode 300, as we're going to be launching the new podcast content strategy. So thanks everybody for tuning in, and I will see you next week.